forward from here with the employment equity. We got responses last time from the department, and yeah, what's the direction here? If there are issues that people want to raise pertaining to this, let's do that, and then get the Mkalipi to give us the presentation, and then we move on. We may even look at if there are no controversial issues. I think we can engage and see if there are some, then we'll deal with them. If there are not, then we may agree on either today or some other time, going through clause to clause, looking at clause to clause, and then taking the bill to its finality. Mr. Mkalipi, do you have or Brasesh?
No, I agree with the direction. Yeah.
Yeah.
In the end, we're going to have to do it for the first one. So let's clean up the resources.
Yeah. Let's clean up, and then other members will join us. How many apologies do we have? We have. Where they are written. Honorable Mwango is still in Devon. Honorable Mushroom, let's negotiate in Lobola. Lobola negotiations. That is what's in the apology, so that you know.
I thought those only happen on Saturdays and Sundays.
The other apology from yesterday, Honorable Albert, he said he'll join us today, but he's not here. Who is this? Williams, where is he?
He's sick.
Oh, Williams is not well. So those are the three apologies. The other members are attending other committees, and I don't understand why this happened, because when committee deals with legislation, all else stops. Even if you are serving in another committee, we have to be with the committee where there is legislation. And I think we need to engage these members and make them aware of that. That is not an apology. The apologies are not accepted. Mr. Mkalipi.
Chair, I'm not sure whether I understand. My understanding is that I'm going to be taking the committee through these issues to prepare them when they do clause by clause, so that they can understand exactly where we're coming from, what are the issues. That's my understanding. On section one, members, this is one of the areas where there's agreement at NetLink, with all the parties agreeing. We are amending section one of the definition of who is a designated employee. A designated employee. And this amendment is influenced by our desire to try and treat all South African citizens fairly. The law as it stands now, you've got a situation where if you're a white male, you are not regarded as a designated employee. But if you're an African from America, you come and stay in South Africa, you will be designated. You will qualify for affirmative action. The fact that you're an African. Now, you've got a white male who's a South African citizen, who's born in South Africa. The law says you're not designated. You've got an African because she or he is an African, although she has not suffered any effect of apartheid. This person grew up in America, got the best education opportunity. Whether they take that opportunity or not, that's not the issue. But they've got access to the all the best America can offer. They've got access to economic activities in America. And let us say they take them or they don't take them. If they come into South Africa presently, they can be designated as African because they are African. And that's the issue that we are trying to change there. Relooking on the definition of designation. And we're saying you can only be designated if you were born in South Africa or if you obtain citizen before 2004, or if you are able to show that you apply for citizen before 2004, for whatever reason, because of apartheid, you were refused that citizenship, and then now you apply after 1994, because then whatever activities that were involved in, let us say, you're an African, you are come from America before 1994, you spent here, you come in 1974. You apply for citizen in 1984. Because you were active in the trade union movement for whatever reason, you supported the trade union movement, the government then refused you citizenship on those bases. And you can show that. And this clause allows you then to, even if you are become a citizen after 1994, but you can show that you were refused citizen before 1994 by the unfair legislation of the apartheid government, you should be able to be regarded as designated. Therefore, there are three things that you are doing. We're defining what is designated in terms of birth, in terms of citizenship, that is before 1994, and we're making a leeway also for people to come after 1994 if they can show that they were denied by the apartheid government citizenship during that period for whatever reason. And although the law does not say yet, the intended consequence of this amendment is that you will be able to treat, to refuse designated status for Africans who are not South African. And treat them as you would treat white males who are South African on those bases. And that's the moral of this amendment that we're making. And that's why all the parties at NEDLAC have agreed on it. In the public hearing, there were comments that obviously now what's happening is that many companies presently go take out people from Zimbabwe and say, well, we employ 20 people from Zimbabwe, therefore our representativity on employment equity should be X because we've got Africans in. Now, if you look on the comments made by the HRCT and Center for Constitutional Right, they are worried about this area, that it deals with this. And they are raising, I mean, two issues in that, which are non-issue. They are saying that it must be clarified. It could be interpreted as inclusive or exclusive of black people only now seeking citizens. But that's the intention of designated. If you are designated, you can be. You can only be designated if you are female or you are black, and we don't think that's a confusion anywhere in that. The other issue that they are raising is this issue that now it's going to be difficult for employers to import representativity, basically, and that's what we're trying to curb. therefore we don't think that's an issue. Yeah. That's section one. And I'm sure now when members are ready to vote, they will understand the rationale and where we're coming from, what's the issue that we want to deal on this issue. The next issue is on section 8. Or section 6, I'm making the mistake. The next amendment is the section 6 of the bill. This amendment dealing with the grounds for discrimination, basically. Presently, in terms of the law, you can only challenge the issue of discrimination around the listed grounds. There are about six: race, gender, religion, all those listed grounds, HIV status, and we've got. There are court cases that have defined that the listed ground are exhaustive. You can't have any other discrimination other than the listed ground. And this is what Section 6 is trying to deal with. It's saying that you might have discrimination between two African males, for example. In terms of the law as it stands, the courts have interpreted that as being not a discrimination issue because it's not listed on the ground. You can only have between a white white male and a black or female male or status in terms of sickness, those kind of discrimination. And we've agreed with all parties at NEDLAC that let us include another ground that says arbitrary ground. If it's an arbitrary ground that is not on the grounds that are listed, you should still be able to go to court and challenge the arbitration. And you still have got the if you look on the comments that you received, you've got the number of organizations that the same one, CLICS, HRCT, and Solidarity, that are questioning the including of the arbitrary ground, saying that the present grounds are enough. From where we're sitting, we're not surprised to hear Solidarity saying that, because we, from our side, we think Solidarity would want to limit any ground to challenge discrimination. I mean, that's what they've tried to show in their action in the courts, the kind of cases that they take up. Therefore, when you make it easy for people who feel discriminated to challenge their cases, they will be on the other hand. They would want to make it to tighten the door. They would want to tighten the door. Now, their argument is that the listed grounds are enough. It's not a legal issue. They just say that the listed ground enough. And for us, we're saying that it's far better to open the door on discrimination than to close it. Better open it wide to bring everybody who feels discriminated to be able to take their case. They say you should not be able to open the door wide. That's basically the argument that they are putting.
That's
what it means. Because
so there could be discrimination against height or body mass. If you are too thin, we don't want thin people. Or if you are big, then it's like, oh my God, anyone exceeding 80 kilograms. want those kind of.
Look, the gentleman, South African, who's been discriminated in New Zealand on the basis that he's big, they don't want to give him citizenship.
Yeah.
And, I mean, those kind of issues this would cater for that because it's arbitrary. Okay, it's not about race, it's not about anything. It's not about sickness per se, because the person is not sick now. They say you might get sick in the future and exhaust our health, what?
Our resources.
Our resources.
So actually, on this issue of the South African in New Zealand, the case against him was dropped, né? Of deportation.
He got extension for 23 months.
To lose weight.
Yeah. Weight loss program.
Section 8. On the amendment that we're making on section 8. On section 8, deal with the same issue on section 8. It deals with a similar issue in terms of testing. This is the what is this organization? Health Professional Issue Council. This is a straightforward amendment that we are making. Presently, the law requires that no testing should take place. The law requires that no testing should take place unless the test has been scientifically shown to be valid and reliable. That's what the law says. And that's the issue that we're solving. Now we're getting calls as Department of an Inspector from employers and saying, we've got this test, we want to do test this test, is this scientifically? And I'll say inspectors may be inspectors and very good, but I mean they do not have the capacity to decide whether a test is scientifically and is reliable. They don't have that capacity, and we are not in a position to advise employers whether you can use that test, you can't use that test. And that's why the amendment is made, to say that the organization that has got a responsibility in the country to deal with tests is this organization, and you say that, therefore, those tests that are done in the labor market must be found to be scientific and reliable by this organization. Now, in the public hearing, I'm going to ignore the one made by this organization itself, because I think they were a little bit confused. Because they wanted, they say we're not going far enough. Because we're saying they wanted us, they want to be able to ask another body to do this and that all works. And we think that, for us, we don't think that's an issue, because their powers are in terms of the act that set them up. If that act allows them to do ABC, that's not what is being changed here. What is being changed is that if they say this test, whether the scientific assessment was done by somebody else that they've asked to do, is their business. We don't have to say it here in the law, in this law. That's our answer to them. But the other people that have queried this, Capes and Mark Roberts and Paradox on two things. They raise two things. They raise the capacity of this organization, whether it's going to be able to deliver. That's the first thing. And they raise the issue of how far do you go to a testing? Is an interview, if we advertise for a post and we interview one of the members who wants to come back in Parliament next year after the election, want to be in the list in any of the parties, is that interview psychological testing? And for us, we say they as psychologists, they should be having that debate in the psychology, in that body, and decide from where we're sitting. We don't think that interviews are psychological tests. They are not psychological tests. They are just tests to determine your suitability for a job. Employers do it every day, even now. If that was the case, then they should be saying that the law as it is, because it says no psychological test is allowed. If they say those interviews are tests, then all the interviews that have taken place since 1985 should not have taken place because they have not been found to be relevant, all of those issues. We think they are misplaced in their argument. We think common sense in this issue should prevail, and common sense says that an ordinary interview for a job application really doesn't fall under this. And if there's any issue, the best place to debate it, they must among themselves as industrial psychologists debate with the council and have an understanding on the issue that they are raising. It's not a legal issue. It's not an issue that you can deal with legally. Basically, that's the issue that they are raising there on those areas, the issue that are being raised there. Then the next section that we're dealing with also, it's section 11. Also, it has been agreed on section 11. Section 11 deal with the issue of honors. It deals with the issue of honors of proof. There was also criticism from other organizations that did not come here on this area. First, there's argument and network in all of these issues. Business accept it, we said accept it, labor accept it. And this honors of proof is doing two things. It's leaving Section 11 as it is now without change. The onus of proof still lies with the employer on the listed grounds. If an employee comes and alleges discrimination on any of the listed grounds, the employer has got the onus to prove that that discrimination did not take place. No change there. The only change is if an employee alleged discrimination on the new grounds that we're putting now, the arbitrary ground, the onus shifts, goes to the employee. The employee must show that the discrimination took place and the discrimination is unfair. And the only reason we're doing that is because arbitrary ground is not on the listed grounds. The listed grounds are clear. I say, I'm black, you're white, you are treated better than me. It's the employer that must come and say, no, yes, he's treated better than you, he's getting more wages than you because he's got more service.
Because his eyes are red.
Well, I prefer the one because he's got more services than you, therefore he's earning more, he has. Or because he's been a good performer over the years, and look on your record, you don't come to work on Mondays, on Fridays, you know, that kind of rational reasoning that you're putting on. Therefore, what I'm trying to say is that we're making only one change. We're not changing the onus of proof as a whole, as only around arbitrary grounds. That's onus. And parties of the network agreed, they believe that it's fair, it gives employers an opportunity to be able to defend themselves when alleged, because they should know what is this arbitrary ground that has happened, how is it unfair, and then they respond. And then you had only one comment on public hearing from Professor Desi Detoit, yes, who believed that you don't need this, the grounds is already catered in the grounds. We don't think that is an issue, and it's not a legal issue. He believes that he's not saying that there's a danger on this, other than that It's already catered for. The next one will be section 21. Section 21. Also, there's been an agreement on that issue. Yes, it's dealing with reporting number of employees, 150 small business. Remember, we offered here to come and show the online reporting, how easy it is, how many pages we've reduced pages, and businesses agreed that online reporting should be streamlined. All parties and have the same reporting date, and if what happens in future if the forms become cumbersome, because the law now it says that the minister must have separate forms. Doesn't matter whether is it two pages each, but he must have separate form. And we say that that separate form should be on the premise that if the forms are cumbersome for small business, then you've got to have a different one. If the forms that everybody signs, just like the taxman is trying to do, is trying to have one tax form that cater for everybody, whether you're small or not, but make it as simple and as clear as possible. And that's the intention of our forms. And as you said, our forms were originally about 23 pages. We reduced them to 12. And we're still continuing busy in the, by the next reporting period, we think it's going to be around about 8 pages. In fact, we want to make our system such a way that if you've reported, there's less information that you must put in. The system must just give you your information and say, you reported last year, yes, you reported last year, this is what you said last year. If they are, is it still the same? Do you want to make changes? And you make those changes. And it should just import the information and give it to you so that you don't have to feel anything if there's no changes. You only feel if there are changes, where there are changes. And the system calculates it for you. When you make change, if it was 5, you make it 4, it will give you the total immediately. You don't have to do anything. And we're trying to make it as simple as possible. And we think that by next year, it should take an employer less than 30 minutes just to fill the form. Because of the importation of the information and all of that. And we want also the information, the system to import from one area to the other. If you do something on one form and it affects the other form, for example, if you make addition on your staff in the form and say, last year I reported 20 people, this year I'm reporting 30 people, in the section about recruitment and promotion and termination, it will tell you, the system should it will tell you that if you're not saying anything when you've increased your staff, because if you increase your staff, you should be able to say, we recruited more, and these are the people that we recruited, and it will direct you to that, to deal with that, if you do not deal with that, so that it can balance with the first one there. And those are the things that we're doing, just to make sure that it's easy for employers to report and to reduce the form further and further that they need to fill. And in this area, there's been agreement in all this at NEDLAC. In the comments, I mean, the comments that have came in is about the issue on small business, basically. People who believe that that if a small business report on a yearly basis, it's a burden to them. And if they report on the same form, it's a burden to them. And as we said, we disagree with that. We do not think it is. In fact, many small business want to report. Because remember, with BEE, they need, if they want to do business with government, they've got to have BEE, they've got to have to be shown to have reported for employment decree. Yeah. Even if they are small business on that, it's got to be shown that they submitted reports and BE does not exclude them. Therefore, now if we say no, small business should only report twice a year and every second year, and that's the problem that they are having, small business themselves. And we think the answer to that is to make the forms very simple and very user-friendly. And if we are challenged on that, that's the conversation that we should have and the conversation that we prepare to have. And as we said, that we've offered to come back here and take members through the reporting form and take them through the changes that we want to make so that they can see how it would look like. The next area of agreement is on section 42. Section 42, the issue around assessment by the DG review process. Now, we're making two changes there in that area. The first one, which is agreed by everybody, we're taking out the issue of categories. We're taking out the issues of categories because they are obsolete. We deal with levels, and everybody has agreed in taking, because President, the law was made cumbersome, the reporting, by having levels and categories. And we've already taken the categories out in the reporting, in the regulation, in the plan, in the regulation. Therefore, employers don't have to plan for categories and plan for levels. We think that's unnecessary duplication. We're taking out of the law also. And the next thing that we're dealing with is the areas that inspectors need to take into consideration, the factors they need to take into consideration before they take a company to DG review. The area about national and regional demography first, we're not making changes there. There are no changes. Remember, there was a big fight that we are changing the law because Jimmy Manu said this and that and that. We want now to change the law. At the NetLeg, the discussion was that we should not make the change there. What we did in that, I'm linking it to this, is that in that area, we gave the minister an enabling provision to allow the minister to be able to say, because the law says now you must use both national and regional demographics of the active population group, how do you use them both? You can't. I mean, common sense tells us that you can't use them both. You can either use national or regional. That's common sense. Now, how do you do that? How do you make that selection as an employer that I must use regional now, I must use national now? Presently, it's absurd. Employers make up that decision. And inspectors make up, as you saw, our former DG make up his own assessment. But the law does not give that guidance. And we say the minister must be able to give guidance here and say, on what circumstances should employers use national or regional? And that will go to NetLeg, it will be published, it will be debated, you might even be able to be interested to see the regulation and also and as members and say whether you comfortable with the regulation. That regulation will come before the law becomes, or the president signs it into law, it will come. That's the first thing that we're making there on those two areas. But the other thing that we're taking out, the thing that we're taking out of the bill, of the section, we're taking up, the section says that before an inspector enforces this law, before an inspector enforces this law, must check the pool of suitably qualified people from designated grouping, whether it exists. If we want to say, come, you are not transformed enough, we should check that, is there a pool of people where COMESH should draw on pilots for it to be able to transform? That's what this act says. Now, members, this is the situation. The law says an employer must have a plan. That's what the law says presently. And it says, in the plan, an employer must look at what are the barriers, what is it that will make me not to be able to transform as an employer. If I say I want in the next 5 years to improve representativity by 20%, that's what I say in the plan. I want to improve representativity of African females by 20%. then I must say, what would make him not to be able to do that? And one of the issues that employers should put in the plan, they should be saying, what will cause me not to be able to do that is because there are not enough African female who's got science and maths, who's got this, to be able to be training as pilots. They must say that in the plan. That's what the law says. The next thing the law says that in the plan, they must say, what is it that they are going to do in that 5 years to get that skill? If they say the barrier is because they don't have science and math, they don't have this, what is it that they are going to do? It's just like a company saying, I want to capture 20% of market share in the area that I'm in. Then that company will say, what would make me fail in doing that? And what do I need? They will put budget, they will do this. Now, if the law presently says that, that's what employers should do, why should then the DG, before he enforce the same plan, because the DG checked the plan, then the DG must go and check out whether there are enough workers, female, African female, in the market to fill the post that these companies wanted to fill. Is that the responsibility of the DG and inspector? Because the law in one side says, you as an employer, you should make up these issues. Then in this section it says, when the DG inspect whether the employer has transformed in terms of that plan, the DG must now check whether there are enough pool of demographic. That's the issue that we're raising. We're saying we do not think it's necessary for the inspectors to be doing this. It's a responsibility of the employer. It should be the employer that says, if we take them to court, it should be the employer that says, Your Honor, I did my best. Here's my plan. I then identified the barrier. This is what I did with the barrier. They might say, well, we took, we wanted 20%, and 20% would have made, mean 10 African females to be pilots. We took 10 African females through the process. All of them failed, or all of them left. Drop out, whatever reason. That's the reason that they are putting to court, or even to us, and say, those are the steps that we've taken. Or they must, they must be able to go and say that. It should not be the responsibility of the inspectors to say, before I check whether you comply with your plan, I must check whether there's suitable enough pool in the labor market. Then why must you plan if I must be doing that? You must be doing the plan, and it's your responsibility to check that. And that's what the first thing that we'll take. We're taking that out because of that reason. And many employers in the report will say they are not happy with that, because employers want anything that will make it possible for inspectors to move to the next step. That's the first thing that we're taking out. The second area that we're taking out is, the law says, before an inspector take the company, the inspector must check, assess the economic and financial factors relevant to the sector in which the employer operates. Members, we say, now, if you are going to expect inspectors to consider economic and financial sectors, now they must run these companies. Economists could not predict the downturn in the labor market. I mean, we're talking about the brightest economies in the world. They couldn't. Now, we want inspectors to assess the economic and financial factors. It's just expecting too much from inspectors. And it's just making sure that they don't do their work. If an employer wants to say, Your Honor, I had my plan. I wanted to train 10 people. I put the budget, 20 million budget I put aside for the next 5 years. But guess what, Your Honor? What has happened? The Americans did whatever, what they do best. They borrowed people money that could not pay back. The economy crashed. My company's value in the Joint Inspector Change was reduced by 50%. I could not afford to continue with the program that I've put in place. That's the argument that they are putting in court. is them who say the economic situation is such that I could not continue with my plan. It should not be the responsibility of the inspector to check those issues. And it goes further, number five, it says they must anticipate the economic and financial circumstances of employers. The first one says that they must check the economic financial sector and they must anticipate. Anticipate what will happen in this company in the next 5 years. It's just asking too much for inspectors. If they were so sharp, they shouldn't be inspectors. If they are able to do that, then they will be making a lot of money in the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, not even working, advising you guys how to invest the money that you're earning. You can't require that of inspectors. And now, the last one, which is the last, inspectors must now look on the number of vacancies and that exist and that are planned by the companies. It's the companies that must deal with that. They know their turnover. When they make up the plan, they will say, our turnover, we've got a 5% turnover here in this company. We know 5% of our employees are going to leave. Therefore, we'll use that 5% for transformation. It can't be inspectors having to do this. And that's the rationale why we're taking these things out. I spend a lot of time on this because many comments that have come in around this area, people thinking that this is very good, we should not remove this. I mean, if you look at it, the SAB, the HR Center, they say the law does not require any change, it's fine. Precisely because it makes it impossible for inspectors to move forward on this. We lost the Comair case, not because our argument was wrong, because of this. Comair went to court and said, well, what was your anticipation of the economic situation? Did you look on the economic factors affecting this sector and all of these issues? We didn't do that. We don't have capacity to do that. And then the judge said, that's what the law says. And that's why we're here now. And we say we can't have that. We could not even debate the merits of the case. It was purely on procedure because the court said you did not follow the procedure as laid out in the law. And we considered that we did not.
Laid on law by you.
We considered that we did not. Precisely because of what I'm saying now. If members can help us and say, how do you do these things? We'll be happy to oblige, but we just think that it's a too heavy burden to be put on inspectors to do this. That's Section 42. Section 45. Also, there's agreement on all those areas. Section 45 is about, it's a simple area that we're making where we're adding the word request. We're doing two things there, recommendation and request. Presently, the DG can only take an employer on failure to implement the recommendation. And we've added there that if a company fails to give the DG information that the DG has requested, we should be able to go to court. If the DG says, in order for me to be able to do work, I need to be able to uh, 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 go to court on that issue. That's the area around Section 45. And then I don't think there's any comment around that area in the public comment. There's no comment on that. There's agreement at NetLink. I'm assuming the citizen of the country also agreed with that one. On Section 48, we're making one change. Section 848 deals with the powers of the Labour Court. This is another Comair legacy. I think the first thing so sorry. Section 48, it's about commissioners deciding on arbitration issues. Basically, that's that. Presently, only the Labour Court can adjudicate on these issues. Now we're giving it also to CCMA commissioners to be able to do that. If you earn below the threshold, and if it's an issue around sexual harassment. Looking upon the comments, there's no comment on that area. All of us agree with the rate of sexual harassment. Vavis Achusa could go to, if you could make it a law today, can go to the CCMA on this instead of the Labour Court. It would have been far easier for them to solve that problem.
Assist us if you include practical examples.
Now the next one is Section 48. For 50. Yeah. Section 50 deals with the powers of the Labour Court. Mm. It's agreed, and there's no comment. It's about, as I've said, this is Comair's legacy. Comair went to court to review a recommendation. The DG made a recommendation, and they went to court to review a recommendation. And the act as it is now, if you look at that section now, it allows to review any performance. Now, we've made change to align this act to PAJA. In terms of PAJA, you can only review a decision, if an administrative decision. If as an administrator, the minister takes a decision, you can review that. But when the minister, the DG, give you recommendation is not a decision. Not saying that you must do this. It says we recommend we do this, and you can refuse to do it. Not forcing you to do it. It's a recommendation. Therefore, you're not obliged to accept the recommendation. You can refuse, and then you go to Labour Court to enforce it. Now, to go to the Labour Court to review a recommendation, we think it's an anomaly. And that's what happened with Comair. And that's the change that we're making here. We're saying this must be linked to PASHA. It must clearly allow parties to review an action, and a recommendation is not an action. And Labour business agrees, and there's no comment made on that area, because I'm assuming that everybody agrees with it. Does not create any harm on that. Then the next one is Section 53. Section 53 deals with the certificate. For people to do business with states. Presently, Section 53 says, if you don't have a certificate, the state can refuse to do business with you, basically. But this section has never been promulgated, has never become law. It's in the legislation, it has not become law. The only thing that we're making here, we enable the minister to come up with regulations to indicate what factors will be taken into account in assessing whether a person has complied or not. Now, we need to explain to members why is this section not promulgated. It was never promulgated. There are two things. First is that if we promulgate this section and we say now, nobody who has not transformed can do business with the state, our assessment is that almost all companies in South Africa would not be able to do business with the state. And if we do that, we'll be killing the economy. Because almost no company can we stand up and say this company is transformed. We can't. There's not a single one. Now, we don't want to take decision because the law allows it and the consequences of the decision are devastating to the economy and to jobs and all those issues. That's the reason this clause has never been promulgated, because we thought that, look, if we promulgate it, the consequences. And now we're saying, well, maybe the minister need to indicate what would we recommend, what would she recommend is compliance, so that... Because if you go strictly in terms of the law, compliance is transformation. You must employ in terms of the demography. If you don't, you can't do business with the state. But if you don't do business with the state is not going to be able to deliver. We're not going to be able to have roads, you know, all of that, and the economy is not going to grow. That's the reason that the area was not published, was not promulgated. And now, well, it's just an enabling provision in this. So that when we promulgate this section, we are confident that we are going to be able to implement it without affecting the economy negatively very much. That's the section. There's no disagreement on that section, except that business, they indicated that they would want to have this so that they would know what is it that we'll look at. That's section 53. Section 55 deals with the issue of regulation, the issue of simplified forms between small and big business. If you remember the explanation that I gave on the forms, this is linked to that, where we say, instead of saying that the minister must make separate forms, we should be saying the minister may make separate forms. So that if this is not necessary to make separate form, we don't make separate form just for the sake of it. We should make them because it's necessary to make them. There's agreement with everybody at NEDLAC, and there's been no comment on that. Section 56. It's about the delegation. I apologize. It's about the delegation. It just allowed the minister to delegate. Instead of saying the minister must do this, the minister should be able to delegate if she wants. If you become minister, those who have not, I've not been a minister, but I know as a minister you sign stacks and stacks of papers. We send papers. You write one letter, the minister must respond, we send it to the minister. Therefore, we're trying to enable the minister a process where she can reduce the kind of number of papers that's coming. If she's confident that we'll apply our mind properly on the issues, she should be able to, if she wants, to delegate some of this function in terms of that. That's what this section is all about. And there's been no comment on that, and it's been agreed. Section 59, it's the issue of breach of confidentiality. This is about inspectors. It's internal, basically, not inspectors. If we receive confidential information as officials of the department, and because we've got friends in COSATO, in what we divulge the confidential information, in terms of the law, the offense to that, it has been 10,000 for a long, long time, since 1985, and it's just been increased to 30,000. There's no comment, and we're taking the issue of also the publishing of government with the Minister of Finance, that the minister should be able to do that instead of having to concur with the Minister of Justice. There's been agreement, there's been no comment that we received. Even Justice on that one has so far has not said anything on that. The next one is 61. It's about fraud, the fines about there. It's the section that I was talking about. Also, it's the same. Remember, the first one is for if proof of confidentiality, that is more internal than external. And the second one is more for employers who obstruct, who obstruct me doing my job, and false information. and 64 and is about. The turnover to the minister to be able to amend the turnover in terms of the schedule. The present schedule, Schedule 5, has never been amended. It deals with the turnover of companies to report and be applicable in terms of Section 21, if you can report, and then the schedule says that if you are in the agriculture sector and your turnover is 2 million, you don't have to do certain things. And maybe in 2085, 2 million was reasonable, but that has not changed.
Money wasn't reasonable.
Yeah, but for an employer, yeah. Yeah, for turnover of an employer, you know, it's nothing, you know. Therefore, I mean, this, and that has never changed. It's always, therefore, what it means is this, the lower the turnover, the more burden it brings to smaller employers. The higher the turnover, the more employers go outside the process. And you want to strike a balance on that. You don't want to get everybody in. You also don't want to make it too high that everybody is outside of it. And the only change that we're making there is a change on the turnover itself first that comes in, but what we're making is that the minister, we should not wait for every 10 years when we amend the law to change this. The minister should be able to adjust the turnover as the inflation grows over the years. That's the only thing it says, and there's no disagreement on that. And I think the last one, we're making changes on Schedule 4, the one that goes with that one. And it's all agreed, we're making up to 6 million now, the turnover. We're saying the turnover starts 6 million agriculture, and then the minister should be able to adjust this as we go along. Those are the areas, members, of agreement where all parties have agreed. There's been some areas, some comments from members of the public. We don't think that the comments from members of the public are, for us, persuading us to do anything different. We hope that they will do the same to you, members. If there's any question before we go to the areas of disagreement, we'll take them.
Yeah, no, I think we can move on to the
the most important was the areas of contention. Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to understand, normally this kind of legislation is there to protect minority groups, people that don't have the majority vote, etc. I'm just asking, we are living in a world, you've spoken about people from America coming to work in South Africa and so on, and it seems to me in this globalization this is happening more and more. You know, Japanese car manufacturers send people from Japan to come and work and so on. Now, it seems to me what you're saying is that those, let's say, international workers, they will be grouped in the group of white males. Am I correct? Which means that South Africans of that group may be pushed out by these international workers. Which means that this minority group, white males, may eventually find it very hard to get employment at all, because these international, also as I understand, you're looking at the different levels in a company. Mm. Normally these international workers, when they come for the car factories or from America and so on, they tend to work in certain specialized jobs. I, for example, had personal experience of where a person from Gabun was appointed as the chief information officer of one of our government departments and so on. Now, it seems to me what you're now saying is that these people from Gabun and Japan and America and so on will push out South Africans out of that. And my question is just, should we not rather park them on one side and say, listen, we've got 20 employees at these senior levels, 4 of them are international people, we don't classify them. We just put them somewhere else. And then for the 16 remaining jobs, let's see if all South Africans have had a fair opportunity to compete for jobs. Because it just seems to me, I don't want to make a law for the current circumstances. I want to make a law for when things have really changed in 30 years from now, then it must just be as valid a piece of legislation as it may be at present. I would love your comments on that. Thank you.
I'm not sure what if you're referring to the to the changes that we're making on the definition, because that's the changes that deal with demographic. What we're saying there is that we're defining who is designated. It doesn't change the status quo of any of the citizen. It only changes the status quo of those who are not citizens. That's what it does. It says that if you are not South African citizen, you come, for example, from Zimbabwe, you cannot be counted. When we count African maids, the company can't say, well, we've transformed because we've brought in 5 Zimbabwean in. That's the end result of what we're doing on the definitions. On the issue that they are raising, the law as it stands does not say how you structure that kind of area, but the regulations do. In the regulation, when you look on the regulation and on the forms that employers submit every year, in that form, they must show how many African males, how many African females, Indian males, Indian females, white males, white females, and they must show foreign national. If a company like Toyota has got Japanese working at Toyota, it will show under foreign national at what level are these foreign national, how many are they. They are separate from white male, therefore you are able to see this is South African. Now, in this case of foreign national, even foreign national after this law becomes law of African descent, for example, will fall under that category because they cannot be used as part of affirmative action. Therefore, when you look at foreign national, it would include any foreign national, irrespective of race, creed, or color, foreign national. But what I'm saying is that presently, in the form, white males are not included with foreigners. You got it separate.
Okay.
Chairperson, may I just ask, in which law do we have foreign nationals as a category in its own? Because I don't read it in the law.
And I've said that the law, this law, does not deal with that. Does not deal with foreign nationals. If you're talking about definitions, they say in the public employment services, they do define the bill, they do foreign national, what foreign nationals are. But in our law, it does not define foreign national. It excludes foreign national from the definition of designated grouping. That's what it does. It does not say foreign national at all. It says, if you you are only designated grouping because you are South African citizen. You were born in South Africa. No, not because you are South African citizen. You were born in South Africa. You became a South African citizen prior 94. Or you obtained your residency prior 94. And it says, or you can show that the reason you did not get it prior 1994 is because of oppression, for whatever reason. Therefore, in this law, it does not talk about foreign national, but it talks about, indirectly, it excludes them from the definition of designated grouping. Therefore, it says, if you are foreign national, you cannot benefit. Because remember, this law gives designated grouping certain benefits. And then it excludes foreign national to those benefits by excluding them from the definition of designated grouping. That's what this law does. And in the reporting, the reports ask how many foreign nationals, precisely for us to be able to ask that question and say, if you bring in so many foreign nationals, why is it that you cannot use citizen in this function? They would say it's skilled. And we are tolerant on areas in the boards, in the executive up there, because that's more many of them are. But you might find a situation where even farm workers now come in as foreign national and all those issues. But what I'm saying is that the law, the Employment Equity Act, does not define foreign national. But the Employment Services Bill that will be coming here, it does define foreign national. The Employment Equity Act, it excludes them from the benefits without mentioning them. It's not mentioning foreign national, but it says that you can only enjoy these benefits if you are a citizen, if you are prior 1994, that definition of the designated grouping. I'm not sure that I've answered the question.
Yeah. Could I say that my understanding, and I want to assure Honorable Van der Westhuizen that whatever definition of foreign national, it don't be an Azanian definition. It will be a definition that will apply to it will be informed by the Constitution of the Republic, not Azanian sentiments. And that the purpose of this is to benefit South Africans who were discriminated against over many years. You know, is to make sure that it's victims of apartheid who benefit from, who will benefit from employment equity. So you cannot deny South Africans a chance to benefit by bringing borrowed Africans from across the borders of South Africa who were not even discriminated against. They never even made an attempt to apply to be South African citizens. But if any one of them can prove that some years ago I did apply for a job in South Africa, and I was denied that job because my country was seen as being hostile to South Africa, that person can make a presentation, actually, and argue that I was a victim of apartheid. I applied for an engineering work in public works. I was not taken because I was an Angolan. There will be difference with other people like Mozambicans who have settled in South Africa before independence, and there is proof that these people came here during the Renamo Wars. they settled in this area under this chief. So there is a record that as South Africans then, as people were living within the borders of South Africa, documented or non-documented, they were discriminated against. So therefore there is a recourse. I mean, you know, there is something for them to fight for. Yeah, I was just saying that maybe that is the way I understand it. And that if you look at the definition, the Azanian definition of an African, it will be linked to the... It won't differ that much to apartheid's definition and, but again, this thing, your race, to say, how fast does a pencil run through your hair? But the Azanians will say that if you've got curly hair and you are dark, so therefore you are black and you were born in the African continent, so therefore you will qualify. That will be the Azanians. And by Azanian, I'll mean PAC, Azapo, and others. I'm talking about parties that are represented in parliament. So it definitely won't go that way. It will be defined by the Constitution of the Republic. Thanks.
Let me see if I can reduce Honorable Van Wey's issue to a practical situation. His point was, as I understood it, that the foreign nationals now will not. I mean, companies will not benefit for employment equity status because they have a black Zimbabwean, for instance, who doesn't qualify. Mm. So the pool of people who don't qualify will increase. In other words, white males and foreign nationals will increase, which would then have an impact on the employment opportunities of the white male South Africans. Right. Now, accepting that scenario, my sense is that it would not matter to an employer whether he employed a foreign national who's not going to get in points or a South African white male who's not going to get in points. So here it would be a competition of skills and needs and whatever and stuff like that. In other words, the concern that he has will be mitigated by the fact that the black Zimbabwean male cannot be preferred over a competent South African white male purely on the basis of skills. Do that make sense?
It is so, except that what's now happening is that let's say white South African males are 5% of the population.
Right.
It means that they will no longer have 5% of the economic employment opportunities.
Right.
Unless for every American that comes to South Africa, a white South African male goes overseas.
Then it stays.
Basically,
yeah.
Okay. And that is, and what hurts me are these people that are contributing to the Australian economy at this point in time because they've exported their skills because, you know, of this notion that they have that there is not an equal opportunity in future for their children. Many people say, no, at this point in time we still know that the balance is skewed in the favor of white males. But what about my children? And therefore, I'm an engineer, I can afford to go to Australia or to the UK or wherever to go and work there, and I'm concerned about my children's future. And what we're now saying is that in South Africa, you will be an American, will have the same chances of getting employment than a white South African male in future, because you fall in that
pool.
Very small pool that are reserved in accordance with our legislation, and that is a concern. If you've said let's park all the internationals because, you know, they fall in a special category of specialized skills or whatever, or because of international links with the mother companies and so on, we park all of them somewhere else, they, you know, and then we start saying, okay, one South African versus the other, let's level the playing field for them. That would, to me, make more sense, because I think our South African economy may suffer in future because of
this kind of legislation. And I don't want to support legislation that will suffer the, you know, make the South African economy suffer. So unfortunately, we've come down to a numbers game. And the numbers game also include now people from other countries. And they are in that small pool of non-designated in South Africa.
I think you've got it wrong, sir. In the sense that, first is that, as we said, that the law does not talk about foreign national or citizenship at this stage, other than defining who designated. That's the first thing. Now, if you look at Section 42, when we check whether a company is transformed in this country, you use Section 42 of this Act. Section 42 says the company must use national or regional demographics. Now, these demographics are published by State South Africa. It covers all citizens. It says in the Western Cape, the Western Cape working population is constituted by 17%, 17.8, that's 18% African, 27% colored, males, 2% Indians, 8% white males, 16% African Africans. It goes on. What I'm trying to say that the demographics, when we go in and implement the law now, the company in its plan says, yes, the representativity in this company. Presently, we've got 80% at this level at senior management, white males. We've got the others, this. What is expected in terms of that section, the company must put plans that will make white males compatible with their demographics. Now, if let us assume that in 20 years' time, white male reduce, and if employment critique, the campaign that says employment equity must cease to exist when the change is made has not succeeded. Let us assume that white males now all of a sudden constitute 1% of 11. That company would not be representative in terms of Section 42. Because Section 42 says use EAP. And EAP says in the Western Cape they are what, 8%. Now if they go to 1%, they are not representative. And Section 42 says use demographic. It doesn't say what you're saying, the language that you put in. But that's what Section 32 says. You've got to lose either national or regional demographics. If those we're not taking it out. It's still there. But what we're going to do, we're going to issue regulation and guidelines that says on what circumstances should the company use national or regional. But the law will still talk to national and regional. But what we're trying to say is that if a company has got to implement that Section 42 and they implement in such a way that white males now constitute below their threshold, that is the case. It's not a transformed company. Mm. Therefore, for me, your question is dealt with Section 42. If you look at Section 42 in its totality, it doesn't say use demographics, EAP of African and female. You've got to use the demographic of South Africa. And in the demographic published by State South Africa, that's what they are doing. And when we go to companies, that's what companies do in their plan. They say, this is, unfortunately at this stage, white males can only benefit, and these are, we're asking the companies, they can only benefit at a lower level to come in as a sweeper, as a what, at a lower level. They are on those levels in many companies underrepresented in those levels. In the higher levels, they are overrepresented. But in the entry level, they are underrepresented. Now, in enforcing the law, those are the questions you're asking companies. You said, what are you doing to bring in this level, to bring in white males and white females at this level. Because when you go to companies, you find out the bottom, there's no doubt, is black and African. It doesn't matter where you go. That's what the bottom is. The top is different. And the challenge is to meet the demographic even at the bottom for white male and white females there, and meet the demographic at the top for the other groupings. Therefore, for me, when you look at the Act in totality, it covers the issues that you are raising.
Thank you, Mr. Mkazi. I just wanted to also elaborate that for a company to be realistic and have a diversified workforce, the law requires them in terms of Section 19 to do a proper workforce profile analysis. And when they do the workforce profile analysis, they will have to take each level, take top management and match it or benchmark it against the economically active population to determine the over and the under representation of all population groups. So that's how we are able to see if whites are overrepresented, if we match them against the national or the regional demographics. At the same time, when setting numerical goals and targets to transform their organizations in their equity plans, they must make sure that there is equitable representation of all groups across each occupational level in relation to the economically active population. And also the same act protects the setting of absolute barriers to non-designated groups, meaning that in setting your numerical goals and targets, you cannot now put a bar in terms of the employment of white males. If you don't get a skill in your designated groups, then you need to put measures in place. You can employ a white male, but then your strategies will be, I'll employ the Honorable Vestation to also mentor Tembinkosi Mkhalipi to be the successor. There must be a succession planning. You need to be assessed on your mentoring and coaching skills to transfer the knowledge and skills to one of the designated group members that will actually take over should you retire tomorrow or decide to resign from that company. So these things are actually safeguarded from all the provisions of the Act, not to set absolute barriers for the employment of white males. So there shouldn't be any problems there. And at the same time, we are saying to companies like Mr. Mkhalipi said, as we go on DG reviews, you are importing skills, bringing people at the executive level, maybe in the mining sector, because you claim that we don't have enough mining engineers. However, you need, as part of your affirmative action measures, put programs in place in terms of the transfer of skills. How are you going to assess these guys, foreign nationals, that they're actually transferring skills to our own local citizens, so that in future we can sustain our economy? I just wanted to also bring over other sections. Thank you.
Chairperson, so do I understand you correctly that in future, because we know those matrices with the breakdown and so on, that the heading will not be white males and internationals as the non-designated group?
It has never been.
No, it has never been, because we have never distinguished between South Africans and internationals.
We did.
But now we need to. In terms of those, if you look at the Commission for Employment Equities report, they don't refer to international.
That's why, you know what, that's why I was saying that it won't be the Assignment definition. The Assignment definition is that all white people are foreigners. You remember with the slogans? One settler, one bullet. You know? Yeah. But I mean, according to them, all white people are foreigners in the country. That's why I said that it won't be defined as that.
Chief, thank you. And that's the value of this discussion. I've just been proven wrong.
Somebody was saying to me that this thing doesn't sound, or it doesn't look very kind to other people. And I was saying that, you know, maybe these are not appropriate words, but there is this poet, German poet called Bertolt Brecht, who wrote a poem dedicated to posterity. and he says he was comparing the revolution with the flood. He was saying those who will emerge from the flood in which we are sinking think that when you deal with what we are doing now or what we did in the past, letting the minority oppress the majority, don't judge us harshly, because that time it made a lot of sense. But then he says, for we who wishes to lay the foundations of kindness, cannot ourselves be kind. You know? Because, you know, we redressing the wrongs of the past and trying to level the playing fields. And when you level a playing field, you are tempering with the contours. You are tempering with the grass and everything that is on the ground. You know, so there will be such a feeling, and we understand why the citizens of this country, some of them will have those kind of, you know, fears that we are relegated now to the ranks of junior citizens. That is not the intention of the law or the intention of this of the Employment Equity Act as it is on the table now. Its intention is not to do that. If there are no any other issues, honourable members, I think we should call it a day. Are they? We were going to...
Yes, while you were away, we were going to do the controversial issues.
I thought there are no controversial issues from yeah, okay.
The first area of non-agreement, it's not a big area. It's 16 and 17, section 16 and 17, but it's not on the section. It's on the schedule of fines, on schedule 1. Section 16 and 17, business says, they don't have a problem with Section 16 and 17. If you look on their public comment, if you look on the public comment, but they fear that there's going to be duplication of funds between 16 and 17. 16 and 17 talk to the issue about consultation, and it's around consultation, basically. Yeah. And now they don't want to comply with 16, which is linked to 17. And then if they don't comply with both of them, get a fine of in terms of this, it's 1.5 million. That's the issue that they are raising. They say they don't want fines, therefore now the fine that there will be 3 million because they did not comply with both 16 and 17. They don't want duplication of fine. And we don't think this is an issue. If you look on that schedule, this one, the schedule 1, 16 and 17, it reads, if anybody contravenes the provision of section 16, read with section 17, therefore it already combines 16 and 17, therefore it means that you can't have a fine in 16 and then have a fine in 17, because you read them together. Therefore, the issue that they are raising of the duplication of fines, because 16 and 17 are talking to the same issues. Therefore, it's not an issue that they are raising. It's covered already. The next area of disagreement is section 20 of the Act, which is the issue of the plan. There's many issues here, capes, and everything about it. They don't want, well, let's talk to business. First, business talk to the word compliant. And we didn't understand what is it that they're saying.
The
saying that they are prepared to accept this section if it will mean that we can only go to court if you don't have a plan, basically. They say that we should not be able to go straight to court if you've got a plan, but the plan is just fanakalo. If you've got something, you write the employment equity plan, but when you go into the details, it's talking about something else. They say that is about whether your plan is compliant with Section 20. Section 20 says your plan must have A, B, C, D, E, F. Now, they don't want us to go direct to court on the basis that your plan, yes, you've got a document that says plan, but when we look at it, it says nothing. They say that's a plan. We should only be able to go to court if you don't have a plan. If we go and check and say, where's your plan? You don't have it. Then we should go to court. But if you've got a plan, even if Ufanaga law were plan, it does not deal with the issues that the law asks. They say, in that case, we should not go direct to court. And that's the disagreement. I'm just trying to explain the word compliant that they're talking about. That we should not go directly to court if we believe the plan is not compliant with Section 16. We should only go to court if you don't have a plan. I'm not sure the members understand the difference here. Mm-hmm. They don't want us to make a judgment. They say compliant is a judgment call. And we say, well, we should be able to say, because that judgment is guided by the law. The law says your plan must have A, B, C, D, E, F. If it doesn't have A, B, C, D, E, F, then it's not compliant with Section 20. We should be able to go to court. They say, no, we should not go to court on the basis of compliance. We should only go to court if you don't have a plan. That's the difference. That's Section 20. Yeah, that's court. But the other parties that are opposed to this, they are not opposing on the basis of that weight. I mean, people like CAPES and Retail Association, they don't want anything to direct to court. The proposal that we're making is that if your plan is not compliant or you don't have a plan, we should just go to court and let the court decide on this. They want, to have a compliance order, to have you'll have a compliance order going to court undertaking the own works. That's a disagreement around this area of Section 20. It's about whether, when should you be going to court. Section 36 deals with the issue of application of appeals and appeals and what is it called? Undertaking to comply.
36 is
yes, undertaking to comply. We're making two changes around that area on undertaking to comply.
Mm-hmm.
We saying that presently the law says an inspector must obtain an undertaking. That's what it says. It says an inspector must obtain an undertaking. Now remember, members, the word undertaking means nothing else than an agreement, a promise. You must attempt to get a promise. If you don't attempt to get a promise, then it means that you can't go to court because you have not tried to get a promise. And our argument is too, is that, look, for a company that we know it does not honor the promise it makes, you can't expect employers and inspectors to continue making. If this company was here with worker A, no promise. Worker B, no promise. Now you say to this worker, this inspector, when they know, you've got companies in the CCMA that go to the CCMA where the commissioners know this company will never settle. Will never settle a conciliation. It will go arbitration. Whatever you say, it will go. And that's the issue that we're dealing with. That's the first thing. And that's the issue that business is worried about in terms of Section 36 that they do not want, and the other parties.
Just a comment in that regard. The problem you usually have, of course, is when you come in with the May, then you have the discretionary issue. But just to wave a yellow flag there.
Yeah. I think we need to explain this thing. That members should understand. This doesn't mean that if a worker comes into the Department of Labor and says, I have not been paid my salary, then it means that the inspector must go to the labor court and say, this worker has not been paid their salary. That's not how it works. You can't do that, because what will happen is that you will, in court, the company will come and say, well, we pay this worker their salary. Here's a bank transfer that shows that the money has gone in. This worker must bring their pay slip, their bank statement for that week. It will show that the money has gone in. Now, what this means is that inspectors will go to the company, because inspectors must establish, I don't want to use this word, a prima facie case. They must establish that there's a case here. If a worker says, I have not been paid, they must establish that there is a case that they have not been paid. And the only way of establishing that is to conduct the company. They are not obtaining an agreement. They say, Mr. Employer, I've got worker A here who says he has not been paid their wages for last week. The name of the worker is this, and this is a clock number that they gave me. What do you say? The employer comes back and say, yes, I did not pay that employee because of ABC and blah, 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 blah. Doesn't matter for what. The employer says yes. Then the inspector says, well, it's contrary to the law in dealing with that. And in terms of the law, if you do not pay this employee, I'm taking you to court on this. Now, that's the process. That's what happens. And that's how it's going to be, because you've got to have facts to go to court. You can't just go to court and say this. When you go to court and say, this employee arrived on the 5th, this employee says they have not been paid on the weekend of this week. I've looked at their payslip, the information that they've given me. I've looked on the bank statement that they've given me. There's been no money coming in. She says the money is transferred through the bank. There's been no money, and I can see in the week before that there has been money transferred from this company, but in this one there's no money. Therefore, this employee has not been paid. I've contacted the company. This is what the company says. You're putting the court in a position to make a decision. Now, if the company says, I'm not prepared to do that, it's good enough for us to go to court. There's nothing else that an inspector needs to do other than that. Take that information. Remember, the inspector must put the court in a position that the court can decide. And in most of the cases, it must put the court, when you go to court, you must put the court in a position to decide in your favor. Sure. I can't go to court against you and put the court in a position to decide for you. Sure. I've got to make my case strong as an inspector. The only way of making it strong is to give the information to the court. Therefore, this does not mean that that interaction is not going to take place. It's got to take place. It's in terms of justice also. You've got to get the information. It's a normal process of an inspector doing their job. But we don't want a situation when an inspector has done all of that, the company come in and say, you did not obtain an undertaking from me. Now, we've got the information here. Here's the information. The worker has not been paid. All of that. But the company says, you did not ask an undertaking. Therefore, the law says, obtain an undertaking for me. And that case is thrown out of court on the basis that the inspector has not obtained an undertaking. The employer is not saying, I'm prepared to pay. I would have given the undertaking. It only says, I have no, you have not. And that's the issue that we're taking away here. And then we're saying, secondly, if an inspector does get an undertaking, not in an attempt to get an undertaking, even if an inspector get a written undertaking from the employer that says, I promise to pay this money, the inspector doesn't have to issue a compliance order for that. There's an agreement on that. And the employer does not pay, then they can take that promise, that written promise, and go to court and say, they don't have to prove anything in court. They must just say, You have an employer, the employer has agreed to pay this amount, they've signed it, they have not met the terms of the agreement. Take that to court and let the court enforce that agreement. It's for the employer to go to court and say, look, I was drunk when I agreed to that, I did not apply my mind, and see what the court will say in terms of that. Therefore, this issue of taking out undertaking, that's what it means. It does not mean the natural processes of justice should not take place. Therefore, you should not hear the other side. That's not what it means. The next area that we're talking about here, I use the issue here, the basic condition of employment act in terms of this undertaking, because it's more, but it applies also here in terms of undertaking. Section 37, it's about compliance order on this section. It's the same people who refuse on the issue of going direct with the compliance order to the labor court. We're not making any changes there. What we're making changes is that there are areas where we say we don't have to issue compliance order and say, please comply. Compliance order is just a begging instrument. You're asking the employer, begging the employer to comply. What we're saying, we should go directly to court on this issue. Now, what are the areas? Where an employer contravenes Section 20, 21, 23, and 44, we should be able to go directly to the labor court on those issues. Now, when you go to the labor court, we'll say to the labor court, the law says this company, any company in South Africa must have a plan. And this company doesn't have a plan, an employment equity plan. We're going to court for the court to find this company the required fine in terms of the law. And that's what this says. Now, what the employers want, they say that presently the law says, if you don't have a plan, we must give you a compliance order. That says you must have a plan. The compliance order is nothing else. It's a promise that the employer is going to have a plan or the employer is going to report. Yes, you're giving a commitment that you're going to comply with the law. And we're saying, well, the law has been there since 1985. It says, have a plan. You don't have a plan. Now we must ask a commitment from you to have a plan. And that's what the employers are asking. They say, no, we like that commitment. Keep the commitment there. And we say, no, we want to go to court for the court to fine you for not meeting the commitment that you gave when you parliament voted for this law. Remember, you're voting on behalf of all of us. You vote for this law, parliament voted for this law in 85. That is a commitment that the citizens of this country are making. They say, we'll comply with the law. Now these guys want us to make another commitment.
Isn't the same with, what do they call this, breach of promise?
Exactly, that's the issue on this section. I mean, section 36 and 37 is about undertaking compliance. 39 and 40 is about deleting the issue of appeals and objections. Now, in terms of the law as it is, members, is that if you contravene the law, the inspector must attempt to give you an undertaking. Now, you must give a promise that says, I'll comply with the law. If you don't promise, then you must give a commitment by a compliance order that I'll comply with the compliance order. If you don't comply with the compliance order, you can then object to the compliance order. You get the undertaking, you get the compliance order, you object to the compliance order. Then, after the objection, you appeal against the compliance order. That's what the law says now. Before you go to the labor court, these are the steps that you take. Now, no other law has got such steps for an administration decision. And what we're saying is that if we issue you with a compliance order, where we issue with a compliance order, the compliance order says comply. Why should you then have a right to appeal and object to that? We should be able to go to court, and then you should make up your case in court on that. It's as simple as that. And that's the decision that the issue this means. This. It shortens the process of enforcement. And the people that like it, it's not about the law. It's about you must make this door as very difficult as possible to reach the final stage. That's the issue. Don't go to court. Put all of these issues in. And we're saying that this does not mean that they cannot write a letter to the DG. If I do something and they believe that, look, this case is not winnable, they can write a letter to the DG. I mean, members of parliament write a letter to the ministers on every day. We don't like these letters because they give us a lot of work, but we respond. That's our responsibility. I mean, if there's a question, if there's a letter written, the minister responds, the DG responds, we'll be happy if there are no letters, but we know our responsibility. Therefore, it doesn't say that they should, now all of a sudden employers cannot, if they feel strong about the case and they believe this case is misplaced, an inspector has issued this complaint order, and they say, well, we think that the inspector has misread the law here, and this issue is not necessary. They can write a letter to the minister. The minister attends to all of those cases. She might not attend to herself about it. If she will make sure that a person that understands that area of the law look at it. And it's our responsibility. And we don't want to waste time of inspectors and taxpayers' money going to court in a case that is irrelevant. It's straightforward. It's our responsibility to say to the minister, we agree with this letter that has been written if an employer feels strong. But it can be a step in the process itself. That's what we want to take out in the process itself. You can't say you can't go to court because I've appealed, I've objected. We don't know the first these steps of objection. We understand in the criminal procedure there is an appeal. An objection, you could know we object to this. I mean, everybody will object. I mean, if prisoners had an opportunity to object for being arrested, they will all object. They'll all object for being, you know, I don't understand in the first place where this issue of objection coming from, but it's in the law. It's not for me. And we're proposing that this is not necessary, members, that this does not take any responsibility away from the minister and the DG to look on any presentation that is made, just like now we do. On there's no law that says that we should be, but it's administration, fair administration, that if something is raised, we've got to respond, and we're responding on each. We might take a little bit of time, but on every case that is put in front of the minister, make sure that it's responding, because it makes the minister good. And it gives the minister a good name also in the citizens of the country. She does a job.
And it's good for the country.
Chief,
just in terms of Mr. Mkalipi's practical explanations, do you say that if a Secretary General objects against suspension?
Then you go to court. Welcome, Baumang. Welcome, Jim.
The last area is Schedule 1. If Schedule 1 is linked to the issue of turnover, business is high turnover, it doesn't matter what you say. They say you can increase the price whatever you want to increase.
Yeah.
Turn over. We are allergic to that. That word turn over. Head on one table. There's no doubt about that.
I agree with that.
And I don't think this is not a legal issue. This is not.
Call the number. Don't bring it to channel. You're gonna kill your case.
We'll leave it.
Get a number. Don't bring it to channel. Then you'll be okay.
But why is the Competition Act okay?
No, it's a different thing. Remember, we're dealing here with something where...
Let's be on record.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I was saying, remember, you're dealing here with a... And I think, just to say, Chair, you said something about the good thing about the discussion here. There is an even better thing, talking about these things in an environment like this where we're sharing ideas and stuff like that. The turnover issue is, from my perspective, and it obviously would link with some of the things that people are saying, is one of those things that I believe can actually be manipulated to the disadvantage of the department. So if you have a number and you work along that number up and down, you are much more likely to be effective than if you do turnover. The biggest problem for business about turnover is that you can have 1 billion turnover and have a loss of 1.5 billion. That's the problem with turnover. And that would mean that then they wouldn't have to pay because they don't have money to pay. So it's just a thought, just something to think about the turnover thing. Otherwise, it's fine. I think everybody agrees there should be a fine, and a significant fine. Just how we find the people who don't do what they're supposed to do.
Can I check, person? My impression is that
turnover
is linked to whether you're a designated employer or not. Isn't that what you mean in Schedule 1 in terms of turnover?
The fine is linked to the employers that are required to do certain things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you look on the fines, it talks to the turnover one, talks to section 20, 21, and 44. Now, 20 is about a plan. If you are not a designated employer, you don't have to have a plan.
Yes.
Therefore, it doesn't affect you. 21 is about reporting. If you are not a designated employer, yeah. Therefore, it comes in there. But, I mean, the issue that I want to come into, Honorable Mudau, is that we've got the fines. The money there,
right.
It says, for the first offense, you don't have the plan, it's 1.5 million, or 2%, whatever the grade. Therefore, the issue of the department might lose, it doesn't come in, because in the court we'll be able to say, if that case comes in, 1.5 is there. Therefore, we've covered both ends in terms of this.
I left Mr. Khalifa here. He hasn't worked for the companies that I have worked for, so he can make the statement. I tell you, but it's a nice discussion actually. Business will find the loophole. I can assure you. We had a big company here. Remember the issue about pensions, about people who have been overpaying in their pensions, where pensions had surpluses? I can quote you 3 big companies in the country which have not paid out because their pension schemes were not making money. And I guarantee you they made billions of money. So,
I agree with that. In any law, in any law you have to put in place, business is going to look for loopholes. That's their business. That's what they employed lawyers, skilled lawyers, to say, what is it that we can do to mitigate against this legislation, in any legislation. It's the responsibility of lawmakers to close the loophole. That's why the tax law changes every 5 years, 10 years, because loophole comes, they close. It's just like water, the river, you close this part, then they go that way. Otherwise, there would be no reason for Parliament if these guys were not finding these loopholes. They are finding these loopholes, Parliament must close them. And that's our business. We can't run away from that. Any legislation that happens.
That's why we love business.
That's why we love business. They give us business.
I say that to law research is easy to study. If somebody goes to court and Babale Agarena, we just have to take a call or write a letter to Mama Shira and say, look in this matter and close the loophole. Mkalipi, Mama Shira, do that. And then we'll have another amendment next year, after each and every case, until we get it right. Yeah, the laws of nature operates that way. Are there other issues that...
that's the last one.
So, which means that there are no very controversial issues on this one, because I think all political parties agree with this employment equity and black economic empowerment. So, and these are... what this is what makes the basis for employment equity. So business will always want to save money, you know. So, and it is their job, they are in business to make money, and ours, it is, we are walking the tightrope. We need to find a balance between labor and capital here, and business things, because they think that they make the rules, and the golden rule is that those with the gold rule. So, but it's not going to be easy. We need to make sure that even those who don't have the gold will have some rules to protect them, and that is where we come in. With these few words, we are not forming a quorum to adopt minutes. We don't have a quorum again to discuss the to discuss and adopt the report. And it's a worrying thing that the members of parliament are not taking this committee seriously. But we'll take that up with the relevant structures of parliament.
Chairperson, may I therefore say that we can expect some of the members to be sitting outside the Chief Whip's office on those chairs in the next few days?
Yeah, no, they'll be asking questions about the election manifestos, the distribution, and yeah. Thank you very much. When are we meeting? Yeah, next week we're meeting Tuesday and Wednesday. And will be, yeah. The first meeting is with. Oh, let me just remind members. Last week, I went to meet with the AG for a briefing about the compensation fund. What are they doing? What are the issues? And blah blah blah. Because our strategic intention is to turn the compensation fund around and make it like other entities within the Department of Labor. And that there are other issues related to a leadership in labor that actually ends up affecting how the compensation is doing. UIF is doing very well, and all other entities are improving. But even those that are improving, when it comes to SCM, who we trade with, things are not improving. And the suspicion is that where there is trading, there could be what you call Zoholeko Bonga Spade, the hand that goes under the blanket, literally speaking. That direct translation of Zoholeko Bonga, or possibly corruption. Because there's no improvement when it comes to those areas. And the intention of the committee, all of us in this committee, We want clean governance. The resources that we are looking after, we need to make sure that we do our utmost best. You know, leave no stone unturned until all these divisions get clean audits next year. There was a commitment, 2014 clean audits. So we've got only one entity that has problems, which will mean that all our energy should be focused on that entity. So the audit committee of the compensation fund is replaced by this now a new committee, and I suggested that we should meet with the outgoing audit committee so that as this committee we can do an exit interview for the committee that is going. They were in, these are the issues that happened during their tenure. What is this that they did to turn things around? Or what do they think needs to be done by the new committee that comes in going forward? What were the challenges that they were faced with so that we can deal with those things when we meet with the new committee? Exit interviews are done to most boards of directors, and there's nothing wrong with us as this committee to talk to the outgoing audit committee. And that audit committee should come and brief us together with the internal audit. And then in the next meeting after this, we can then call the newly appointed audit committee to come and tell us what is their way forward. How do they see themselves working with us, an internal audit, turning the compensation fund around? The most painful thing about the compensation fund is that most people who have problems with compensation are people who are less fortunate than us. People who cannot understand contracts and what contracts means. And we're dealing with business that is not willing actually to part with money, as you can see in this discussion, that people are worried about how much is the fine and not the impact of non-compliance of those who are supposed to be getting something from us. So that's just a little motivation why we need to take this route, the exit interview, and then briefing by the new committee. So that will be on the 17th, and then on the 18th, and then on the 18th will be the Triple P. In my meeting with the AG last week, she mentioned in passing that, I'll be in Cape Town because the department is making a presentation to SCOPA about the Triple P. And then I said, no, but we don't know about this. But anyway, let's go and attend the SCOPA meeting. So we postponed our meeting yesterday so that we can go. We can attend the SCOPA one and benefit from their experiences in their dealings with the department. And I just hope that everybody benefited the way I benefited from that meeting. And the same questions asked by SCOPA, we're still going to ask the same questions. And we can even add more because we deal with the department all the time, more than SCOPA does. So I just urge members that let's prepare for this next week meeting, the end results of which may help us in getting clean audits in 2014, as there was a commitment when we started that there will be clean audits by 2014, which is next year. Thank you very much. This meeting adjourns.
Sorry, there's an invitation from Ned Langdon.